Support this podcast via our Patreon and get more writerly goodness. Visit patreon.com/nanocast to join up.
Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer. I'm the author of some 27 books, 34 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, and I am your guide on this journey to raise your productivity to pulp speed levels and to explore the cracks and crevices of business and craft in the writing life.
Welcome to The Questions, episode 602.
I return today from the Valley of the Shadow of Flood to find questions. Questions from people like Robert in Australia, who says,
a follow-up to the question, testing your premise. Loved the episode, but I was actually trying to ask something different. So here goes. Perhaps you've got an idea, but you don't know if it's worth writing. You don't know if it has legs, as they say in the film industry. Can it go the distance? For example, I find myself with ideas. Well, a Q-ship's in space. A kid notices people are being replaced with robot clones, etc. At some point, if these ideas are going to become a novel, a decision has to be made to fill them out and then a further decision to proceed with writing. Obviously, this might differ a lot between a plotter and a pantser in practice, but I can't help but feel there must be a lot of similarities in testing an idea, whether it's through working out what characters would apply, what the broader implications are, etc. I'm finding that with some of my work, that I realize I haven't developed some areas enough and recognize it will require significant editing as I discover a lot of my story, world, settings, and/or characters as I wrote, despite having outlined. My understanding is that you aren't a big believer of many edit cycles. So how can we make sure we have the key elements lined up to begin with? Can we save ourselves time and pain by determining early that a premise is unlikely to work as is? Are there warning signs? How much do we need to know before we put fingers on keyboard?
Well, Robert, you should embrace your English heritage. The modern world is, and by the modern world I mean everything for the last 500 years at least, is a argument between the English and the Germans. And the argument is based in the reality that the Germans face, which is that any time they do really well, everybody invades them, because they're afraid that if they don't invade them, they'll invade everybody else, which they do. And the reason is that Germany is vulnerable on all sides geographically, with low-lying lands and very hard-to-defend borders. And also, really good farmland, very desirable forests. It's the kind of place that is just big enough to be a threat to everybody and just impossible to secure enough that it is under threat if it is not threatening to other people. Because of this, in order to survive, German culture developed planning, and they perfected planning. There is a reason that German cars are some of the best engineered cars, some of the best engineered anythings the world has ever seen. It's the same with German electronics and other stuff that comes out of Germany. It is, you just assume because it's German that it's better. Well, this is the reason. If the Germans don't do everything better than anyone else, tanks roll over their borders and their people get shot. So the German way of thinking is very command and control, very top-down. You have a very limited number of resources. You have to execute them because it's life or death. And so you do everything you can to control as much of the process as possible, from the way you think all the way up to the way you tighten a screw and package something for market, or the way that you fire a bullet and speak to your superiors. The English way of thinking is the opposite. English geography is automatically secure. The British Isles haven't been invaded in 2,000 years, almost. And it's because there is a bloody great ocean, even though it's just a little narrow sea. The English Channel keeps the European armies off of British shores. And the geography inside England is such that it is very hard to govern it in a command and control style, But if you allow the localities to govern themselves and you just police as a central authority, you just police the interactions between the localities, the whole system flourishes, generates a fantastic amount of wealth, and secures more power for the people at the top than it would if they tried to micromanage things. And every time people at the top have tried to micromanage things throughout English history, the system has fallen apart into civil war. This is what gave birth to the English common law tradition. The nobles realized that if they kept their hands off the peasants, they got better rents, better revenues from their tenants and their underlings. And so they basically didn't get involved, and the English had to learn to police their own communities. And this affects British epistemology from the bottom to the top. It affects the English arts tradition, it affects the English political tradition, the economic tradition, and the legal and philosophical tradition. Only in Britain could you get someone like Shakespeare. And only in British colonies could you get a place like Australia or a place like Canada, which is a weird combination of French and British, but French is a whole other situation that's not really relevant to this question. I swear this is all going to be relevant. And only in England especially could you get a thinker like Darwin. At the time that Darwin was doing his thing in England, it was Hegel and Schopenhauer in Germany, and that gave birth to the Marxist tradition and the fascist tradition and that sort of thing. Then the reason is that Schopenhauer and Hegel were looking for the perfect grand unified theory of everything historical. They wanted to be able to explain everything in such a way that would allow them control over history, because German history is very volatile and dangerous. And that affects the thinking. But at the same time, in England, you have Darwin doing his thing. Now, what's Darwin's thing, and Alfred Russel Wallace as well? Their entire thing is that reality unfolds through self-governing processes. The world you see around you is a dialogue between living organisms and their environment. And society and humanity and agriculture and companion animals and wild animals are all manifestations of this same rule of living things interacting with their environment and the world that we see being a product of that dialogue. This all shows up in the German educational and creative traditions. The Germans are very, very big on ideological artwork. That artwork is integrated philosophically from the bottom to the top is very, very important in the German tradition. So you get artists, great artists like Goethe, who produce very little artwork, but it's very, very good. But it appeals to a very, very narrow audience. In the English tradition, you get the pulp writers who keep tossing stuff off, throwing spaghetti at the wall, hoping that it'll work sometime. Pulp writers like, for example, Shakespeare and Dickens, and in the American version, Poe and H.G. Wells. The pulp writer phenomenon is an English phenomenon. It is a procedural mindset. You discover things as you do them. Now, I'm obviously biased in this fight. I think that this is an accurate picture of reality. And so I approach my writing and whatnot to attempt to take advantage of what I see as the basic mechanism of how reality works, which is that you put ideas in dialogue with each other and you let the finished product emerge from their interaction. And you don't try to put too firm a hand on it. You have the hand of the craftsman at the tiller the whole time, filtering the signal from the noise, so to speak, deciding what goes down on the paper. On some level, but that's about it. So that's a long discursion to bring you to the answer that I have for you as far as how you tell if an idea has legs. If you're a German, in terms of your thinking, an idea has legs if it expresses something important about the world and it makes, and you are absolutely certain that you have to get it out just right so that it is the best it can be. If you're an Englishman, an idea has legs if you find another idea that sets it off in a way that's exciting and that drags you along for the ride. Another way of saying that is, if you're a German, an idea has legs as long as you care enough about it to die on that hill and to work on it until it's right. if you're an Englishman. An idea has legs if you can't contain it. And it is generally if you can't contain it that people in Hollywood and other arts mean when they talk about, does the idea have legs? And as far as how you learn to tell that, as you write, as you develop your bibliography, a history of things you've completed, you will begin to notice and pay attention to the feeling you get when you're on to a winner. It may not a commercial winner, but at least an artistic winner. Something that when you're done with it, you sit back and you go, oh, yes, yes, that's what that should be. It's developed through experience. You pay attention to that idea, and that helps guide your selection of what to work on next. Now, you can also introduce, I recommend being careful about how you do this, but at some point everybody does have to introduce a little bit of marketing into the equation, because if you've got three or four ideas, all of which you're more or less equally enthusiastic about, so creatively speaking they've all got legs, you have to decide which one you're going to spend your time on. And that is where your question of your market comes into play. Do three of these ideas hit your existing audience where they are? Do they live up to their expectations from you? And number four takes you off into left field, takes you into a new genre, takes you into an emotional landscape that your readers are not used to following you through. Then you have a choice. Are you going to take the risky path, which may mean that the idea does not have commercial legs, or at least not until you have some other works join that idea over there on that side of your artistic spectrum? Or are you going to listen to your marketing wisdom that says these books will sell dependably, all other things being equal? That's a second sense you get. That one's quantifiable. You can actually look at the sales and the sales curves if you're keeping track of your sales, not just by sheer numbers, but by time. And you're keeping track of your marketing efforts and whatnot, you can get the raw data as to what your audience is going to respond to. So that is not an art. That is much closer to a science. It's a gambling type of science. It's a statistical science. It's not always going to be right, but it is closer to a science than an art. As far as what's got legs aesthetically and what's going to pull you along, that English notion of the idea you can't contain, that is something that you just have to develop a feel for. You recognize your own emotional state. The term emotional state is maybe not communicating correctly. It's a deep feeling in your bones. It's not, are you happy, are you sad, are you excited, but a sort of instinctual conviction that you and this story understand each other, and you're willing to go on this journey together, or you even desperately want to make sure you go on this journey with this story because it's going to show you things about yourself or the world of your story that you wouldn't see otherwise. So I'm sorry it was a bit discursive, but hopefully it helps. I would encourage you to embrace your heritage as an Englishman in this case. If you get the impulse to invade India, I would encourage you not to embrace your history as an Englishman. But in this case, this is a positive aspect of your heritage as an Englishman. So, good luck, and thank you very much for the question. I'll see you tomorrow. The Everyday Novelist is written and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2018 by J. Daniel Sawyer, and the production is copyright 2018 Artistic Whispers Productions. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License, and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners.